Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the irony that just as the Republicans are uniting around Donald Trump, divisions among Democrats appear to be widening, with one of the main points of friction between the Clinton and Sanders campaign being the head of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Named the best political writer in Florida, Adam Smith, the political editor of the Tampa Bay Times, joins us to provide a local angle on the polarizing Florida congresswoman who, as chair of the DNC, will preside over the Democratic convention in Philadelphia, where instead of brotherly love, there is likely to be an eruption of booing the minute Debbie Wasserman Schultz gavels the convention to order. As pressure builds among grassroots Democrats to dump Debbie, we'll examine whether the efforts by Bernie Sanders and others to support Schultz's primary challenger will cost the controversial congresswoman her seat. Then we'll get an update on the political impasse over funding to prevent the spread of the Zika epidemic that has struck Central and South America and is moving north into the southern United States. Stephen Morrison, Senior Vice President and Director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic International Studies, joins us to discuss the delay in funding that could put about 2 million pregnant American women at risk and why raiding the funds for Ebola and offering $622 million instead of the $1.9 billion requested will end up being penny-wise and pound-foolish, since the cost of prevention will be a fraction of the costs of a spreading epidemic. Then finally, we will speak with Oscar-nominated filmmaker Josh Fox, who helped spark the anti-fracking movement with his film Gasland. He joins us to discuss his final film in the Gasland trilogy, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, which opens in L.A. on June the 3rd and airs nationally on HBO on June the 27th. We'll discuss what the oil and gas industry calls the shale oil and gas revolution, as well as the other revolution as millions of people around the world organize against fracking. And joining us now is Adam Smith, who's a political editor for the Tampa Bay Times, who was named the best political writer in Florida by the Washington Post and one of the country's top 10 political reporters by the Columbia Journalism Review. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Smith.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a congresswoman, I believe, from Fort Lauderdale, is obviously very controversial, and Bernie Sanders is backing her opponent, Tim Canova, an activist and law professor, in a primary run against her. But I think it's fair to say there's gathering disquiet amongst a lot of senior Democrats, because it would seem obvious to me that since Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the chair of the DNC, she'll be presiding over the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, and it's unlikely that there'll be a display of brotherly love, particularly as she gavels the hall to order. It's quite likely that half of the hall's going to be booing her. What's your prediction?
Well, I think if you were to take a poll of those in the hall, more than half would be less than thrilled with her. She remains fairly popular in her district in South Florida, overwhelmingly Democratic district, but she really does have very few friends and allies in Washington on any side. White House isn't crazy about her. Hillary Clinton world isn't crazy about her. And Lord knows Bernie Sanders folks can't stand her, thinks she's got the thumb on the scale in this primary.
Well, throwing shade, as they say, from the beginning, I think it's pretty clear. I was astounded at the way she organized the debates, as though she was trying to bury the Democrats' message at the time when the Republicans were breaking records with eyeballs and ratings on television. It never made any sense to me. What was the sense in Florida, and particularly in her local community, about her role?
Well, I think in fairness, you could say, let's say you stipulate that she has been a Hillary person all along, which I think is probably true. She was a very, very strong Hillary person when it was Hillary versus Obama in that primary in 08. But I think in fairness, you could probably assume that it was less Debbie Wasserman Schultz that wanted to bury those debates than the Hillary Clinton campaign that essentially asked her to or were eager to have her bury those debates. And that really was, I think, a mistake in hindsight. Hillary Clinton's very good in those debates. They just assumed that anything that would elevate Bernie Sanders, who they assumed would be this very, very long shot, would be unhelpful. And it turned out they would have been better off having more higher priority debates. But, yeah, having a debate on a Saturday night, you know, holidays, et cetera, Sunday nights, that was clearly they were trying to bury it. And when Debbie Wasserman Schultz would deny that and say what was obvious to everybody, it didn't help her credibility.
Well, in fact, they had some of the debates up against big sports events, and I did actually speak to some of the Clinton pollsters at the time, and they were quite dismissive of Bernie Sanders, as though he was going to be another Howard Dean, that he would rise like a meteor and then flame out. And that clearly has not happened. It's pretty amazing, isn't it, how dogged Bernie Sanders has become in this campaign and how Hillary Clinton simply cannot shake him.
Well, there's no question, if you were to have asked anybody that followed politics and political history a year ago, whether Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee and a low-profile socialist senator from Vermont would be giving Hillary Clinton a serious run for her money, almost nobody would have predicted it. So, nobody expected he'd be, comparing him to Howard Dean is probably generous. Howard Dean looked like he had a much better shot than Bernie Sanders did at this point.
So tell us about Tim Canova, the law professor. Apparently, I take it he's got a shaven head. He has a headquarters that's a storefront adjacent to a Pilates studio, which he frequents. And Bernie, I think, has managed to raise about $300,000 for him. I take it he's got to be an underdog. She's been the congresswoman for some time, has she not?
She's been a congresswoman for some time, and I've known her since she was in the legislature, where she was a standout legislator in a Republican-controlled legislature. She really was one of the strongest voices for progressive Democrats. But she has never—I don't think anybody knows much about her challenger, except that it's going to be the first very serious challenge she's had almost forever, if not forever, and— Yeah, she's probably pretty ultimately going to be safe, but she's going to have to work a lot harder than she ever has. She's going to have an opponent who's not only not a fringe candidate, but is going to probably have significant resources in large part because of Bernie Sanders.
So it would seem to me then Debbie Wasserman Schultz's real vulnerability is back in Washington, D.C. at a recent press conference where the minority leader, Nancy Pelosi, was trying to make some points to the press. They kept turning around and asking her about Debbie Wasserman Schultz and how long she could be chair of the DNC. And this is a time, and you have to admit, Adam, it's pretty extraordinary irony, is it not, that at the moment when the Republicans, who have been extremely fractious throughout this primary season, appear to be coalescing around Donald Trump, and there seems to be some real display of unity with, you know, a couple of fairly significant holdouts. But in general, the feeling is on the Republican side, they're coming together. On the Democratic side, they're spinning apart. And at the press conference, Nancy Pelosi had a sort of deer in the headlights look, saying, why you guys keep asking me questions about Debbie Wasserman Schultz? Well, I'm sure when she left the press conference, she realizes she's got a problem on her hands, surely.
I think that's right. And the other irony is also that I think most people in Washington don't think that Nancy Pelosi is especially crazy about Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Debbie Wasserman Schultz she's done a lot of just sort of clumsy things over the years. She was she was sort of fueling speculation and chatter that she would be the next speaker after Nancy Pelosi, which kicked off a lot of Nancy Pelosi people who didn't think she was likely to go anywhere. She wasn't. Kicked off the White House, the Obama White House. She was suggesting she might run for U.S. Senate for a long time. There's always been, more so in Washington than in Florida, really, there's been a perception that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was sort of out for number one more than the overall party as a whole. And that has not served her well.
Well, it's pretty clear that she was had problems with her deputy at the DNC, the deputy chairwoman, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, who's a military veteran and a very impressive speaker. She apparently had some went toe-to-toe and felt that in fact Debbie Wasserman Schultz was tipping the scale against Bernie Sanders. And lo and behold, Congresswoman Gabbard is now a supporter of Bernie Sanders. So even within the top ranks of the DNC, there's been some fairly, I imagine, pretty intense friction.
For somebody like me who's known Debbie Wasserman Schultz for a long time, it's kind of striking to see just how Washington, and this is going to sound more negative than I mean it to, but how Washington changes people. I remember her as a young legislator who was sort of a straight talker, spoke her mind. You could get a solid, actual human answer from her. Now, I mean, she, even in comparison to national party leaders who speak in sound bites automatically, she just has a tendency to say nothing. I mean, to say just talking points to the point that they're not worth listening to. And I was saying, having a conversation with somebody the other day, saying I can't remember a RNC chair or DNC chair who in recent history who I've cared to listen to less than Debbie Wasserman Schultz, because she's so robotic. You know, you ask her about why are you hiding these debates, and she'll just sort of give you this knee-jerk, nonsensical answer about, no, putting a debate on a Saturday night up against a big sports game, that's not hiding it, that's highlighting it. You know, that's, you know, Reince Priebus, for all his problems, he will give you an answer that is at least semi-credible and worth listening to. Just, that's something that she's lost that skill.
Well, it's not as if Bernie Sanders is giving up the fight here. He's pushing not just for her to step down as chair of the DNC. He's also asking the DNC to remove a couple of prominent Clinton supporters, Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy and the former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank. He's trying to get them taken off panels that determine policy positions and procedures for the convention. So, again, you get the feeling that in the city of brotherly love, the Democratic convention's not necessarily going to be peace, love, and puka shells. You know, already they're sparring pretty intensely.
Yeah, which is why on the other side of the coin, that Bernie Sanders is generating more ill will than he has in a long time, because, you know, there was a time not so long ago when he was loath to really sow dissension in the Democratic Party, and he, now that he's gotten a lot closer to the nomination, he seems more than eager to do that. You could make a point of, what's the point of attacking and calling for Debbie Wasserman Schultz to resign? She's going to be out anyway. I mean, whoever is the nominee is going to control the convention and the DNC. Ultimately, the next president, there's going to be a new DNC leader no matter what. So this is, really doesn't matter that much at this point that Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the DNC leader, because her days are numbered anyway.
Well, Adam Smith, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Smith, who's a political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. He was named the best political writer in Florida by the Washington Post and one of the country's top 10 political reporters by the Columbia Journalism Review. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an update on the political impasse over funding to prevent the spread of the Zika epidemic. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is J. Stephen Morrison, Senior Vice President and Director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has directed several high-level commissions, served in the Clinton administration, and as a committee staffer in the House of Representatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Morrison.
Thank you, Ian.
And there's a recent study that suggests that 2 million U.S. pregnant women could be at risk of Zika virus, as here we are on the cusp of summer, and already the Aedes aegypti mosquito is proliferating in the southern states of the United States. And yet you have this peculiar paralysis on Capitol Hill, where back in February, about 90 days ago, President Obama asked Congress for $1.9 billion to combat Zika and the epidemic that it is causing. And all they've offered is $622 million. And as far as I know, that hasn't been delivered. And both sides are just squabbling. Is that what's happening here? We're fiddling while the Rome is burning?
Well, this standoff between the administration, the Obama administration, and the, particularly that House of Representatives Republicans, is dramatic and very disturbing. The administration came in with this $1.9 billion request. Congress sat on it for a number of weeks, and then the Senate moved ahead with an action of $1.1 billion in new emergency funding. So not $1.9 in new emergency funding, but $1.1 billion. What the House has done is offered up $622 million of reprogrammed money. That is, they're taking money out of existing programs, particularly money from the Ebola response, and redirecting it. And so on several grounds, the administration is objecting strenuously to the actions that are underway in the House. Now, we're heading towards a situation where the House and Senate will begin deliberating on how are they going to bridge these two positions. Why is it that there's so little action? I think there's a couple of things. One is, it's the political cycle. We're in a highly polarized, highly partisan political cycle right now, and it's very difficult to get any cooperation on important pressing matters which require cooperation and consensus between House Republicans and the Obama White House. So they're running up against that. They're running up against the reality that there's no clear method for funding these kind of health security challenges, these responses to these unforeseen dangerous outbreaks. There's no regularized annual budgeted approach on this. These emergencies are treated as single episodic emergencies, so it requires the administration to mobilize and come forward with money. So there's a problem that we face. We're seeing recurrent outbreaks of this kind. We've had Ebola, we've had SARS, we've had pandemic flu, now we have Zika. These are not just one-off things that happen once a decade. It's becoming much more recurrent, yet we don't have a consensus on a more continuous and regular way of funding these things. So it leaves you vulnerable to getting caught in the short-term political standoffs, and that's what's happening here. The other thing I'd say is, Ian, is the threat that Zika poses is not yet fully manifest, and that impairs our ability to get moving quickly with adequate resources. And what I mean by that is, yes, there is a threat that the Zika virus is going to be spread in the summer months in coastal areas of the United States and beyond. Puerto Rico is going to be very, very deeply impacted. There's a possibility. We don't know if pregnant women who become infected with the Zika virus, we don't know what percentage are likely to suffer brain damage or some form of birth defects of their infants. There's one study that just came out yesterday that says the number could be as high as 13% of women who become infected, who are pregnant, who become infected, may wind up giving birth to an infant with major defects. But we haven't seen that fully play itself out. It remains more of a hypothetical proposition, and the science around all of this is very uncertain. We have not had a new outbreak of birth defects in the United States since 1964-65, the rubella outbreak. We have never had a birth defect pathogen carried by a mosquito, and no one saw this coming. The science has been very murky and quickly evolving, I think there were those in Congress who were skeptical of the administration, who were skeptical of the true threat. They weren't feeling all that much pressure from their constituencies. They may have felt complacent in thinking, well, most of Americans live with screens and with air conditioning. Well, the reality is, of course, that there are very large, poor populations in the United States living in dense settings where they don't have screening, they don't have air conditioning, they're near stagnant water pools, they're very vulnerable to these mosquitoes, they don't have good access to health services for testing and the like, and that's a real hazard. But those populations also tend to be less empowered. They tend to be more marginalized. They tend to be people of color, and that's a terrible reality. At this time. Now, some governors and some elected officials on the Republican side have stood up and made strong statements. Senator Rubio stepped forward and overtly supported the full $1.9 billion request for new resources. He's been very active on global health issues over his tenure. He understands, and he's broken with ranks and come out in support of this. There are other officials. Some of the governors have begun to speak up more, as some of the elected representatives from those coastal areas. I think what you're going to see is a continued inadequately funded effort that's robbing Peter to pay Paul. If we're taking resources away from very important domestic public health functions, we're taking resources away from very important Ebola capacity building efforts in Africa and elsewhere. You know, we're selling ourselves short while coming forward with inadequate resources to really fund early on a robust response. And if we wind up with a proliferation of cases of these tragic cases of infants born with brain damage and other birth defects, you can imagine how poignant and that will be. It will be enormously traumatizing for those families. It'll be enormously expensive. Caring for a child of that kind ranges from somewhere from $1 million to $10 million over the course of that child's life. And of course, it's a life of lost productivity and functionality that is the true tragedy, and you can't put a number on that. So I fear that we are, as you say, we're fiddling while the storm is building. But most people don't yet see that in its full reality. It's delayed. We're not going to see it quite yet. I must say that the administration has gotten moving very early and quickly in responding to this. I think the UN, the Pan American Health Organization, has also been very, very active in this regard, and hopefully we'll see more resources coming forward in the coming weeks.
So you've made it very clear, Stephen Morrison, that we're being penny wise and pound foolish in having sort of lowballing it and robbing Peter to pay Paul, taking funds out of the Ebola program to combat Zika with less than half of what the Obama administration is asking for. And that still hasn't happened in any case. And then when you measure the potential cost, particularly with children with microcephaly, that could cost millions to sustain these children through a lifetime and a stunted lifetime at that, and all the anguish and psychological pain and the insecurity that pregnant women are going to be having in the south of this country. We've seen what's happening in Brazil. It's the most horrible thing imaginable for a pregnant woman. So I guess the question is, can you approach these recalcitrant lawmakers with the argument that this is penny wise and pound foolish, that if you don't act now, it's going to cost you a hell of a lot more than $1.9 billion in a year or two?
Well, I think that the members of both the House and Senate they're not insensitive to pressure and criticism. Even the action that I described in the House moved along and accelerated because there was such mounting a criticism. I think that the public health officials, elected or academically based, or you know, they need to be speaking out vociferously. Some have. Peter Hotez at Baylor Medical Center in Houston has been very vocal and very eloquent, and I think that his voice is heard, and there are many others like him who are speaking to this. I think in our political season, it's pretty clear this is going to be a rough and mixed process, and we're going to have to just keep pressing ahead. This round of funding is not the first round. This is not the only round. This is merely the first round of response. If this turns out to be, if Zika becomes an endemic problem in which there's year in, year out threat of this, this is going to require a mobilization at home and abroad that's very long term. Keep in mind a few things. One is there is no vaccine for this. When rubella outbreak occurred, German measles in 64-65, there were 20,000 children born with defects. There were another 20 or 30,000 who were miscarriages or terminated pregnancies. 4 years later, there was a vaccine, which every child in America now gets. And there is no rubella in the United States, so there's very, very few isolated cases. We are at least 4 or 5 years away from getting a vaccine for Zika. We're starting really from scratch on that. What are we going to do to protect women in their childbearing years and their partners? Keep in mind that this virus can also be transmitted through the male, through semen. If I as a man go to a Zika area, I get infected, I get bitten by a mosquito bearing the Zika virus. I may not even be symptomatic. The majority of people do not become symptomatic, but I can be carrying that virus, and I can go back, and my partner may be nowhere near a Zika area, and I can infect her. And if she becomes pregnant, she will be at risk. So this is a complicated situation. We don't have very many ready-made tools for protecting women and their partners, women in their childbearing years and their partners. There are huge dimensions to this in terms of access to contraception, access to abortion, sexual and reproductive rights. Those are complicated and very polarizing oftentimes and divisive issues in American society and elsewhere, but they're at the very center of the response to this. as is accelerating the development of key technological tools like vaccines, good diagnostics, and therapies, things we don't have. The other thing I would say is mosquito control, which sounds like a very mundane thing, vector control, control of mosquito populations. That is essential to lowering the risk to women and their partners. And yet that's something that is done at a very local level. It requires a lot of hard work. It requires a lot of resources and a plan. We have, in the United States, we have something on the order of 700 or 800 jurisdictions with responsibility for mosquito control. It's a patchwork and highly variable capacities. Each one of those areas, if they're in a coastal area or they're in an area where the particular mosquito, the Aedes aegypti mosquito, is going to move in during the warm months, then those authorities need to really be mobilized and focused. They need to have good action plans, and they need resources. They don't have much in the way of budgets, most of these, for mosquito control, nor do they have the machinery oftentimes and the expertise. And that's going to be part of the long-term solution, just like vaccines will be part of the long-term solution. But it's going to require a concerted effort over several years. I think we're heading into a period where there's going to be a lot of frustration that we didn't get moving more quickly with adequate resources, and also a lot of frustration that we don't have ready-made answers today for how we're going to better protect vulnerable women and their partners in this next period. We're going to have to do a lot better.
Well, Stephen Morrison, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Morrison, who's a Senior Vice President and Director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has directed several high-level commissions, served in the Clinton administration, and as a committee staffer in the House of Representatives. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the Oscar-nominated filmmaker Josh Fox about his latest film in the Gasland trilogy, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Oh, we've got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is the Oscar-nominated filmmaker Josh Fox, who helped spark the anti-fracking movement with his 2010 film Gasland, the final film in his Gasland trilogy, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, opens in Los Angeles on June the 3rd and airs nationally on HBO on June the 27th. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Fox.
Hey, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
And in terms of the fracking shale oil revolution, one of the things that I find kind of ironic about this is that, of all people, it's the Saudi Arabians who seem to have really done enormous amount of damage to the shale oil business. Their strategy on the part of this young crown prince, deputy crown prince, who appears to be running the kingdom, is to essentially flood the market with oil to drive the frackers out of business. Is that your understanding?
Well, it's interesting when you mention the shale revolution. It's difficult to tell whether you're talking about the drilling technique, which the industry calls revolutionary, or the fact that there is a grassroots movement against shale gas and fracking, which is a true environmental-based revolution, which is happening all across America, all across Europe, all across Australia, and the world. So, you know, when I think of the shale gas revolution, I think of what's happening on the political side and how that's an awakening of political consciousness. You know, in Saudi Arabia, one of the oil ministers, I think the most recent oil minister, famously said the Stone Age didn't end for lack of stones. And what he meant by that was he's signaling the end of oil, that they'd rather have sold all of their oil off at $20 a barrel than have a lot of it left in the ground when it's useless, when in fact we've transitioned off of fossil fuels. So it's unclear right now if Saudi Arabia is simply signaling the end of what they think their era is and selling it all off at fire sale prices, or that they're obviously trying to kill off the American shale gas industry. Either way, these are the sort of tyrannical market manipulations of the fossil fuel industry, which are essentially undemocratic, polluting, accelerate climate change, and perpetuate this kind of geostrategic manipulation. And I think that's what a lot of people are, not only that, but climate change and the groundwater toxification pollution that people react to. And when I've traveled all across the nation and all across the world, I've seen people who are bounding together not just to be against this polluting thing that's in their backyards, the fracking, but also for renewable energy, for the wind and for the sun. And I think we can buy ourselves out and get ourselves out of this sort of dictatorial cycle of being manipulated by business and by those dictators by getting off of fossil fuels altogether. And I think that it's interesting that this is sort of Clash of the Titans, which is, I think, bringing them both down in a lot of ways.
Well, there's no question that here in Los Angeles, we got a real dose of, when you talk about manipulation, one of the ways that we've been manipulated is into believing that natural gas is non-polluting, which is not, but is less polluting than coal. And you've seen billions and millions of ads from the oil and gas companies touting the virtues of natural gas. But we had a big storage facility out here in Los Angeles that was an old oil well from the 1950s that they'd put high-pressure gas into, and it leaked and leaked forever. And the most virulent thing about methane is that it's so much worse than any CO2. It lasts for so much longer. And there's no inventory done anywhere, as far as I can tell, on how much methane leaks from fracking, from the grid, from all the way into the house. And at this point, it would seem that the figures are pretty clear that they offset any advantage because of the leakage of methane. And of course, we got this wholesale dose of it all in one huge emission, which I think was the equivalent of millions and millions of cars on the road. And it was a total obscenity. It went on forever. And it's still, people still haven't returned to their homes. So do you think the consciousness about that, to me, is the biggest lie, that the leakage of methane is what's offsetting any possible advantages that the burning of natural gas would provide?
Well, this has been known in the research for quite some time, for about 5 years now, since the first report came out of Cornell that showed that the natural gas industry went out there to the public and also to the environmental community and to the Democratic establishment and said, we are cleaner than coal. We're better for climate change than coal. So you're at a climate advantage if you switch from coal to gas. Well, as it turns out, that was completely untrue. And it was untrue because the natural gas industry was hiding the fact that their gas leaks out of all of their systems. It leaks when you frack, you billow off, you vent off methane straight into the atmosphere for several weeks before you can hook it to a pipeline. The pipelines leak, the power plants leak, the LNG terminals leak. It leaks out of our major cities. So when you add up all that leakage, and you're right, methane is 84 to 105 times more potent in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide is as a warming agent. So if carbon dioxide is one blanket on the atmosphere, methane is 84 blankets on the atmosphere. So when you have even just a small percentage of leakage, let's say 2%, you're doing worse than you're doing with coal because you're burning about half the amount of CO2. So all that CO2 plus the methane leakage. And as you saw at Aliso Canyon, Porter Ranch, that was the single largest point source of greenhouse gas emissions in the world. Right outside of Los Angeles, one of these storage facilities popped off, just like what happened in the Deepwater Horizon, except it wasn't oil this time, it was gas. And that gas flooded into the atmosphere and created an enormous situation of havoc for the residents, because obviously they had health effects from all that methane in the atmosphere around them. It was very lucky that that thing didn't catch on fire, which it could have. I've been to gas well storage facilities that have caught fire, where they took 3 or 4 weeks to put them out. Those special crews that we saw in the Gulf War from Kuwait had to be called in because these fires were so bright and burned so hot they could be seen from space. So, yes, the big lie right now is that the natural gas industry is better than coal. That's not true. And the real unfortunate circumstances for the climate and for our Democrats, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, is that they've gotten the chemistry fundamentally wrong on this. They allowed themselves to be taken in and bamboozled by the natural gas industry and have now created plans through their environmental regulations to switch over the entire American power grid from coal to natural gas. The natural gas industry calls this the bridge fuel. We're going to use a bridge to get to renewable energy. Well, we're already on the other side of that bridge. We already have the technology to move to the wind and the sun and to geothermal and all these incredible renewable energy technologies that we can utilize for our energy needs. We don't need that natural gas bridge. But unfortunately, Governor Jerry Brown, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, they've been pushing this idea, which creates 30 to 40 more years of dependency on this fossil fuel of natural gas, 300 new frack gas power plants proposed, thousands of miles of pipelines, and it would probably necessitate 2 million new fracking wells throughout the United States of America. This would be a disaster for the climate, a disaster for our environment, and it would, of course, once again firmly place our government in the hands of the natural gas and the fossil fuel industry. That's why I'm so adamant about campaigning, and you're right, talking about this, and it's worth noting that Bernie Sanders, is the candidate who rejects this argument, who says we can go straight to renewable energy. And I think that's why it's so important that people turn out for Bernie Sanders in the California primary. He's the only candidate that is actually listening to this science and not getting the chemistry wrong.
And again, I'm speaking with Oscar-nominated filmmaker Josh Fox, who helped spark the anti-fracking movement with his 2010 film Gasland, the final film in his Gasland trilogy, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, opens in Los Angeles on June the 3rd and airs nationally on HBO on June the 27th. Tell us about that title, Josh. What are you getting at? Because it's both provocative and a little ambiguous, you know?
It was a difficult title to arrive at. It's because, you know, when I started working on the fracking issue, I walked into this issue 8 years ago, a lot like Forrest Gump, kind of like, well, what is this all about? I don't know who's right. Are the environmentalists telling the truth? Is the gas industry telling the truth? I very much sort of, went all across America learning about that issue and then figuring out how, of course, it was very much the case that the citizens were telling the truth, that fracking is extremely harmful both to groundwater and to air and to public health, and then going out there and saying, well, let's just try to stop it then. With climate change, that would have been the position maybe perhaps 25, 30 years ago. And so when I walk in with the very same attitude in this movie, I find out really quickly that many of the things that we think are the most difficult and upsetting and horrifying aspects of climate change, it's already in many ways too late to stop. We have already warmed, and that's a hard thing to process, but it's too late to stop some of the most dangerous and difficult aspects of climate change. And these are the facts. We've already warmed the earth through our greenhouse gases and industrial processes and agriculture and so forth. We've already warmed the earth by 1 degree. Now, a long time ago, we didn't think 1 degree would be so much, 1 degree Celsius, but it's gotten everything on the planet to start melting that we need to stay frozen. The polar ice caps, it's made the atmosphere 5% wetter. That means many more extreme storms, extreme hurricanes, extreme tornadoes, patterns of weather changing, more extreme drought, more extreme flood. It also means the rise of the sea level. We are at 1 degree, as I said. We have already enough carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere now to bring us to 1.5 degrees because there's a radiative effect that will last several decades. So we're already, for all intents and purposes, at 1.5 degrees. So if we turned everything off right now, all emissions, we'd be at 1.5 degrees. So at 2 degrees, we lose 30 to 50% of the species on the planet because we destroy the coral reefs and other habitats. We engender a process of 5 to 9 meters of sea level rise. Now, 5 to 9 meters of sea level rise at 2 degrees. Now, that means 800 million climate refugees. That means New York City goes underwater, Philadelphia, Boston, Washington, D.C., Providence, Miami, New Orleans, parts of L.A., parts of San Francisco. The Central Valley becomes an inland sea as water comes through San Francisco Bay and comes into Sacramento and the Central Valley. You know, this is a vision of the apocalypse, and it's a vision that we don't encounter enough. So when I saw that we are that close, and we are certainly not on a path to stopping at 2 degrees, we're a path of going to 3 degrees, or maybe even higher than that. That put me into a position of extraordinary emotional despair and sadness and grief, and I think that's the how to let go of the world part of the movie. And it's very difficult. It happens in the first half an hour. You kind of run through this incredible collection of experts, from Bill McKibben to Elizabeth Colbert to Lester Brown, Van Jones, Michael Mann, all of them weighing in. And it starts in a personal way for me when I noticed that the trees in my area in the Upper Delaware River Basin in Pennsylvania and New York are all dying because they're being eaten. The hemlock trees are being eaten by a parasite called the woolly adelgid. And then right after that, New York City gets slammed into by Hurricane Sandy. It's kind of a 1-2 punch. It wakes me up. It sets me off on my journey. So then I realize in that moment of despair, that this question formed. If these are all the things that climate change will destroy, what are the things that climate change can't destroy? What are the things that are so deep within us as human beings that no storm can take them away? And that becomes the journey of the next half of the movie, and that takes me all over the world, from the Amazon, investigating oil spills with indigenous environmental monitors, to the Pacific climate warriors battling against Australian coal on the high seas and traditional hand-carved canoes blockading coal ships, to China, where human rights monitors are talking about the coal industry, even at peril of losing their own civil liberties. And then, of course, to New York City and across the United States to deal with people who are coping with climate change in incredibly innovative and resourceful ways. And the things that climate can't change, those are our civic virtues. Those are what lives in our heart. That's love, that's community, that's human rights, that's democracy, it's creativity, it's innovation, it's courage. And the film becomes, in many ways, an energizing tribute to what makes human beings worth saving in the first place, what makes our civilization worthwhile. And the film is that kind of emotional roller coaster. And so, yes, the very long title, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, is a very much an affirmation of what we have to become if we're going to get through the climate calamity with any shred of human dignity. Because human beings are going to be navigating the most intense period of change we've ever encountered as a species. And the only way we will do that is by reaffirming and changing the values of which our system is built. You know, we're built on a system right now of greed, of consumerism, of violence, of institutionalized racism, of individualism. And we have to shift towards more sustainable values, love, community, human rights, dignity. These are the things that we have to start to invest in if we're going to make it through with any sense of peacefulness and of decency.
Well, I recall, I don't know whether, actually it might have been Ronald Reagan who once said, talking about the need to get rid of nuclear weapons and for world peace, etc., back during the Cold War. And it's worth mentioning that was a persistent threat to the planet itself, the nuclear arms race throughout the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And that is one thing that shows that human beings can actually solve. This was a problem of their own making. The idea that they could annihilate the planet in 30 minutes in the name of defense was always a basic insanity. But nevertheless, it existed for decades and decades and sort of went away. Not entirely, but it went away. So that, on the one hand, that gives you hope. But on the other hand, you're talking about being realistic, that we have passed the threshold of stopping climate change and the effects of it. But what about this idea, going back to this idea of Ronald Reagan's, that, you know, if some threat came from Mars or something, the entire world would unite. Well, I know we may not be the best, he may not be the best source to quote, but I remember him saying that. Now, let's take that analogy and think about the idea that we're all in this lifeboat together, and that what this should engender a form of global patriotism, because this is a threat to everybody on the planet. So can it be used in that way to unite us against a common threat?
Well, I think so, and I think that's what the film is about. You know, the film goes to six continents, 12 countries, and you know, everywhere across the world, when people are really looking at climate change, and this is in the indigenous world, you know, with the tribes in Sarayaku, deep in the Amazon and Ecuador, all the way to the city dwellers in New York City, this sense of collective action and of that kind of value, I think is coming through, and that's what's so remarkable. And I think that's what makes this film watchable. You know, I mean, I really literally quit the movie after the first. You know, when you see in the first half an hour, I said, "Send the camera into the heavens," and I just become a dot on the landscape. I said, "I can't handle this anymore because it's too much," and I go out and try to find the people who can get me back up off of my feet and who are the people who have no choice. And that, you know, you go to Samoa and Vanuatu and just remarkable places and remarkable individuals. And I think we're seeing that type of global citizenship, that type of global concern emerging in the people that are on the front lines of climate change, but also the people who are on the front lines of politics. And, you know, that's why we're doing this tour. We're on HBO at the end of June, yes, of course. But we have been touring all across the United States. It's called the Let Go and Love Tour, for how to let go of the world and love all the things climate can't change. The Let Go and Love Tour is about going to all these communities and cities that are specifically imperiled by climate change, as LA is. And we're also opening, I think, in Chicago and Dallas on that weekend. But we're going to communities that are fighting the fossil fuel industry in their own backyards. And that's taken us, you know, all up and down the East Coast, last night in Telluride, to, you know, next couple of days in Colorado, and then, of course, in L.A., and then, you know, we've gone all up the Pacific Northwest, and we're meeting communities that are fighting. And I think America has become an amazing, amazing moment because, you know, we're a country right now of oligarchs, like the Koch brothers, like Donald Trump. I would add to that, unfortunately for most establishment Democrats, Hillary Clinton, and movements. The movements are where the power is in America. If you don't have $1 billion to buy off our government, join one of these movements. And I think those movements are coming together in a way that's unprecedented with the Bernie Sanders campaign. I mean Occupy. I mean the climate change movement. I mean the fracking movement, LGBTQ, the resurgence of the labor movement, Black Lives Matter. We're seeing this, and yes, of course, the movement to elect Bernie Sanders. We're seeing people in the streets in unprecedented numbers, happening with a sense of enthusiasm and a sense of mutual purpose, because it's true. You know, when you look at really the issue of climate change and fundamental economic inequality are inextricably linked. 50% of global emissions come from the top 10%. 1 hour in a private jet is equal to 1 year an average person spends in their car. You know, we have to tackle these problems of both political and economic inequity and climate change. They're linked. They go hand in hand. And that's why we want people to come down to the theater. I'm going to be there on the night of June 3rd. I'll be there on the night of June 4th. On June 3rd, at the Aria Fine Arts, at the Lemley Theater, there's information at howtoletgomovie.com. I'll be there with Shailene Woodley, a great movie star and political advocate, and Frances Fisher. I could say the same about her. And the I think the prince of L.A. in terms of renewable energy, Ed Begley, will be there with us on June 3rd. And as well, on June 4th, I'll be at the theater to answer questions with people, and we're going to be there with musical dynamo Gabriel Mayers, who we've been on tour with. And I think some of the local activist groups, as well as Food and Water Watch and Center for Biological Diversity, we want these film screenings to be a part of that conversation that you're talking about, a part of that unifying moment where we can start to talk about politics and climate in the same breath, and work with that global sense of values that I see as emerging and that are pervasive throughout the film.
Well, just in closing then, Josh, what's your sense of, you mentioned when I started out talking about this, the shale gas revolution, that there's two revolutions. There's the one that the oil and gas business have sold us to give us the idea that somehow or other energy independence through oil and gas is the way to go, whereas the other revolution you're talking about, or the counter-revolution perhaps, is this global movement that you're a part of, that you've helped start. And there's no question, your first film, Gasland, the idea that you turn the tap on and flames come out is such a powerful image that I think it grabbed people all around the world. This global movement surely doesn't depend upon a Bernie Sanders, even though he's helped galvanize activity in this country. It will go on, surely.
I think so. And what I've seen in this, in the 8 years of doing this, you know, from the moment the natural gas industry knocked on my door and said, "Oh, well, can we lease your land for fracking?" And I said, "Well, let me look into it." You know, and of course, we never did that, and ended up instituting a ban on fracking into the Delaware River Basin and also in all of New York State. What I'm seeing is things that people's movements were told, you can't do this, you'll never accomplish this, like with the New York fracking ban. You're never going to ban fracking in New York State. That train's left the station. Well, 6 years later, we proved them wrong. And I think you're right. I don't think it is dependent on Bernie. I think that Bernie is, I think, in many ways a hero and an icon, because for 30 years, 35 years, he's been saying the same things, and the world has finally caught up with his message, and I think it's so important. But I agree with you. I think the global movement that we're talking about, which is a progressive movement, which is a movement that cares for people, which is a movement of compassion and of ethics and of moral imagination and of dignity, I think that is the thing that makes me the most optimistic about the future. The primary word, I think, in the title of How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change is love, you know, and that is something that I'm seeing really become an amazing moment on the planet Earth to live through. If you're not a part of that movement or those movements, whether that's, you know, Occupy, Black Lives Matter, the climate change movement, the fracking movement, then you're missing out. And I think we need that kind of strength more than ever in the face of what looks like to be America's new love affair with authoritarianism and fascism in Donald Trump. That is an incredibly grave danger, and that we need to bind together to make sure that that is defeated. The bigotry that that stands for, the authoritarianism that that stands for, the warmongering, the ignorance of climate change, all of the things that that Donald Trump and our new infatuation in America with this type of insanity, we need the movement-based politics, we need the grassroots, we need the enthusiasm more than ever. And so, you know, I mean, that's why I've been having such a brilliant and amazing time out on the road, because we've been meeting these people from all across the nation in our theaters during our discussions, and late night in the bar, we go out and play music after it, and that we're going to be doing that again in L.A., go out and play music in the bar after the movie. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I do feel a sense of just this epic moment on the planet Earth, which I see as this incredible clash. And I think we all have to weigh in and figure out how we play our part to defeat the forces of evil, to believe in ourselves, to believe in community, to believe in human rights, to believe in democracy again. And I think alongside of that goes climate change activism, renewable energy, the things that empower people, that make communities more sustainable, better places to live. Those are the places I want to be. And, you know, we're really looking forward to being welcomed in L.A. by the great community there, and take part in that when we show the film on Friday night.
Well, Josh, I thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Oscar-nominated filmmaker Josh Fox, who helped spark the anti-fracking movement with his 2010 film Gasland. The final film in the Gasland trilogy is How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. It opens in Los Angeles on June the 3rd and airs nationally on HBO on June the 27th. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.